Hey, welcome to Sounding Off with Kim Munson. I am thrilled to have on the line with me Joshua Scharf. He is a senior fellow at the Independence Institute here in Denver, and he's written a really important piece regarding this whole COVID-19 Wuhan virus reaction disruption. The title of the op-ed is "The Burden of Proof Lies with Those Locking Us Down." Joshua Scharf, welcome to the podcast.
This is my pleasure. I'm glad to be making my debut on this. This is a really exciting new project you got going.
It really is a great new project because we're able to look at these issues a little more in depth. We're not constricted by the broadcast clock, and we're able to be a little bit more unplugged on these issues. So let's talk about this, Joshua. You said that in our current coronavirus pandemic, public policy has been driven largely by standard, epidemiological models, which predict the spread and death of the disease based on a few well-understood parameters. But restrictive business, economic, and social measures have been put in place based on those predictions. You said we've been here before. Take it from there.
Right. So I thought it was interesting that as I was reading over the weekend, over that particular weekend, a book called In the Wake of the Plague by a very respected medieval historian, a fellow named Norman Cantor. He's since passed on, but he wrote some of the seminal texts in this. This is a popular history. This is a book that pretty much anybody can pick up and finish in a weekend, about 200 pages. And in it, he talks about the effects of the plague. That's sort of the purpose of the effects of the great plague that happened in the Black Death that happened in the mid-14th century. All right, fine. One of the things that stuck out at me, though, is what he said that after a year or so, the public officials thought that they had hit something that worked, and that was the quarantine, the idea of quarantining off sections of a city where the plague had manifested itself. Except that maybe it worked and maybe it didn't, and it wasn't so clear that it actually worked, but it was really important that the public officials make it look as though it worked because this was a program that they had put in place. And so it was important, therefore, in terms of public support, that they sort of get the word out there that this was an effective thing to do. And I think we see very much the same dynamic going on with much of what has been done with respect to the coronavirus, where we have public health officials who, having relied on these models, then prescribe this sort of a shutdown. We have politicians who, having decided to put the entire policy in the hands of these public health officials, saying, okay, well, that's good. If that's what we need to do, then that's what we'll do, and putting the force of the government behind these shutdowns and lockdowns. And so they have an investment in making it look as though, I shouldn't say they have an investment in making it look, they have an investment in these things working, and therefore they have an incentive to claim that it's worked, even if it's not so clear that every last thing that they did was necessary or had the effect that they wanted it to have.
But you know what I find so interesting, and I think a lot of them have not thought about this, is that we're going to walk through this, and then we're going to be able to look back and scrutinize just exactly what has happened. And so I don't think that they realize that they will be held accountable for these decisions, and also that we will shed light on just what happened, Joshua Scharf. So they really need to prove, you know, show us what it is as they base these overreaching decisions on about our lives.
Right. And I think that's part of the problem. I think they realize that they will be held accountable. And so what they're trying to do is set the narrative that everything that they've done has been uber effective, which is why we haven't seen, fortunately, the death tolls that we were all sort of fearing when this thing started. I think there's a tendency when they look at the original modeling and they look at the numbers, you know, where when this thing started and they were looking at potential deaths, God forbid, you know, in the millions here in the United States. And now, of course, it looks like, fortunately, it may well come in, even given the sort of interesting counting and the incentive to count things as coronavirus related, where they may or may not be, that will be in well under 100,000, which is you know, not nothing, and certainly not nothing to somebody who's lost someone, but on a national scale, clearly better than 2 million.
It's not 2.2 million. Yeah, it's not 2.2
right,
million.
Exactly. Right. And so I think there's a tendency to ascribe every one of those, 2.14 million deaths that didn't happen, or let's just say it comes into it. Every death that comes that didn't happen is clearly a measure of clearly a result of these things that they put in place. And I think that's just not necessarily so. I mean, the way that these models work is that you start off with certain original numbers. They're estimates. And so you start off with these sort of original parameters, that these guesses of what you plug into this, and you do that based on, in this case, it was data from China, which was probably not reliable, to understate it. And the Chinese had been lying wildly about what happened there, so it was not reliable there. But the data from South Korea and Japan was certainly much more reliable, and so we had something to go on. You plug those numbers in, and then you see what happens over time, and your models will converge to actual transmissibility, how easily this thing is transmitted from one person to another, how lethal it actually is. And so your numbers converge, and then you begin to get a better sense of what might actually happen. Well, of course, this doesn't have any predictive capability at the beginning, right? Because what you're doing is you're operating with numbers that are sort of that have very wide error bars, and then you narrow those down over time. So, what that means is that a lot of the deaths that didn't happen are really attributable to the starting point where the models started out, rather than to any measures that were actually taken. There's number of in terms of social distancing. How much does it really reduce the spread of the virus? It's clear it reduces it somewhat. You're not breathing on people. You're not sneezing on people. You're not doing those things. So that obviously is helpful. But I don't think at the time that these measures were put in place that we had this really good quantitative relationship between these kinds of behaviors result in this amount of reduction in social interaction, which results in this amount of reduction in the spread of the virus. I don't think we had those quantitatively. The way that the people selling the modeling sort of wanted everyone to believe.
So Joshua, in your piece, you said that it doesn't necessarily mean that the modelers and the public health officials and the politicians were wrong to make those initial recommendations that they did. You said they're just normal and it was routine modeling questions that they should have to answer. But we should be able to ask them this without them moving the goalposts around. So take it from there, Joshua Scharf.
Yeah, I'm trying to give everyone the benefit of the doubt here. I'm trying to assume that at least in the beginning, at least for the most part, and in most cases, the people who are the public health officials have a very specific job to do, and that job is to look after the public health of the people of. In the case of the CDC or the FDA of the country, and then there are local and state level public health officials as well. They have tools at their disposal. They have these epidemiological models that have been developed over time that are solid models once you get the parameters put in for an individual disease. There are or an individual, a location. I mean, we see issues with New York that we wouldn't see in Weld County, for instance. So there are these are good models, and they have them at their disposal, but they're imperfect, and so I think they have a particular job to do, which was to minimize the number, not just to minimize the number of overall deaths, but to minimize the number of deaths from this particular virus. Right? The politicians, I think, got scared. And they also didn't want to be on the wrong side of, well, why didn't you listen to the, why didn't you listen to the experts when this large number, when 2 million Americans died, why weren't you listening to the guys at the CDC who were telling you how to deal with this? Because they were all afraid of being on the, plus, I mean, a certain sense of responsibility. Nobody wants to see people die from a plague or an epidemic. So I think there were incentives for them to be very conservative in the beginning. And over time, they were guessing. Polis, Governor Polis here in Colorado, was sort of guessing. Even as we're trying to open things back up, he's guessing at what will work and what won't work and what's doing what isn't. And I think that's acceptable if he's honest with people. What I think has been oversold is the specificity of individual measures that are being taken. And so I say, well, you know, we know that there will be a reduction in the spread of the virus if social distancing is reduced by a certain amount. And I just don't think there's that specificity. And I also don't think there's that specificity between, well, if we do X, if we don't let restaurants open, if we don't let these particular things happen, then we know that we'll reduce, you know, social distancing by so much, and that will translate into a reduction of the virus by a certain amount. I just don't think there's that level of quantitative assurance. And so I think that's been oversold. There's nothing the matter with asking those questions. You know, at the time that I had that I initially sort of sat down to write this piece, they had not released any of the modeling. What they had released was a headline that said, "Well, you know, there'll be somewhere between 300,000 and 33,000 deaths." Well, that's such a wild range of numbers that you can't possibly make public health decisions. You can't possibly make policy on the basis of that. Well, what was happening was that the spot where, again, according to the modeling, the spot where we were was right in that knee, right? It was very sensitive to what we were doing. So, you know, if we didn't do as much and we just nudge that up a little bit, then the hospitals would be overwhelmed. If we did just a little bit more, then it would keep it well below the hospital capacity. That was what was driving that output. But it wasn't clear. And the idea that they didn't make this case initially. They didn't say initially, here's what we're doing, here's why we're doing it, here's why 6 feet is important, here's what it's intended to do. It sort of infantilizes people. And there's nothing the matter with pushing back against that and saying, well, show me where this comes from. Show me why you're prescribing this particular thing. Show me why it's important, you know, not to, you know, we're talking about a few hundred people up on Loveland Pass, going and skiing or snowboarding down the side of the hill. Show me how that's going to translate into a specific number of cases that show up. And they couldn't do it. And the fact that they wouldn't do it, the fact that they're doing things like closing parks, or closing in Denver, I guess they're closing parks, but they're closing parking lots, in order to discourage people from using the parks that they say we should be using. I mean, there was an incoherence and an inconsistency to the policy. And I think it's because they were flailing, but then it sort of became the regular way of doing business. You know, we'll sort of figure out stuff we can do. And I think at some point, I mean, you see what happened in Michigan and you see what's happening now in California, with the beaches, where there's this disconnect between what they're doing and the effects it'll have, but they're doing something to be doing something. And it's tremendously destructive.
Tremendously destructive, not only to the economy, but also to civil rights. And so, Joshua, this last Thursday in my hometown of Lone Tree, Colorado, where I served on city council, there was a quote-unquote special emergency meeting by the city council. It was a virtual meeting where they went in and they shored up an ordinance regarding enforcement powers of the city. And then upon opening up, they are going to require that every retail establishment that has people that come in indoors, that everybody has to wear some kind of a face covering. Now, I don't know quite, you know, what the penalties might be yet. They're now going to have an executive order that's going to explain what that will be. And what was so interesting is the mayor used the words, we will be collaborating with our businesses to help us make sure this happens or to enforce that. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, our businesses not only now work for the government because they go out, they risk their capitals, they create their businesses, and then they collect sales tax. They have to pay somebody to collect sales tax. So they collect sales tax for the city, and now they're going to have to, quote unquote, be part of the police powers of the city. There is something so wrong about this, Joshua Sharp, and the erosion of our civil rights and the destruction of our economy. I think that we will look back and we will be able to put this at the feet of these politicians and bureaucrats and interested parties that have gotten drunk on power and have not been able to provide us with the proof of the decisions. I agree with you. Off the bat, we didn't know for sure what this was. It was prudent to take some steps on that. But when Hancock comes out, Mayor Hancock, and just arbitrarily says we're closing down Denver for 8 weeks, what that does to businesses is I don't see what kind of modeling he could have based that on, Joshua Scharf.
No, I don't think he was. I think he was sort of looking for something to do, and I think he was painting with a very broad brush when it wasn't really necessary, and it wasn't very well thought out. I mean, if you remember at the very beginning, at the very first press conference when he started talking about this, when he announced, you know, the shutdown of non-essential businesses, there was confusion over whether liquor stores were considered. I mean, you're saying in front of a bunch of reporters, and you don't know whether liquor stores are, that's obviously of special interest to the press, but I think that to the working press, as you know, we can attest. But I think there's a sense that this stuff just wasn't thought out to begin with, and then there were attempts to overreach. And what you've seen, as bad as some of the stuff that's happened at the county, at the state level, is, I mean, some of the worst abuses have happened at the county level, where Summit County is now saying that people shouldn't visit their second homes. It's one thing to say you if you have, you know, a rental property that maybe you shouldn't be renting that out, or if you have a hotel, let's keep the hotels closed. And that actually makes some sense just from a pure health standpoint, in terms of making sure that rooms are cleaned and the staff. I mean, if we've seen what happens in nursing homes, you can see where hotels which don't have anywhere near the same protocols might be at risk. That makes some sense. But to tell somebody they can't visit a second home that they occupy, Gunnison doing the same thing. You have Clear Creek County and Gilpin County saying that people who don't live there can't travel on county roads. You have, at one point, San Juan County tried to argue that they were permitted to keep people from visiting state and federal land in their county, which is clearly overreach. So some of the worst things have happened at the county level rather than even at the state level. I think there's a I'm not, in all honesty, I'm not so put off by the idea of wearing a mask. That's just me, and I understand that people may feel differently. But I think that there's evidence that it helps slow things. Nothing is perfect, but that it helps slow things down, and so there's value in that. I get the idea that there are some. We don't want to pack 50,000 people into Coors Field to go watch a Rockies game, you know, and end up with 4,000 on the walking out stick when they came in, and that all makes sense. But I think at the same time, one of the initial mistakes and one of the catastrophic mistakes was trying to make this distinction between essential businesses and non-essential businesses. What the distinction should have been made was: can you operate within these parameters of distancing? Can you operate within those parameters and operate your business safely with that, or can you not? And if you can't, then okay, you know, you, like any health measure, you're going to have to close down. But the idea that it's okay to go buy your gardening supplies, for instance, at Home Depot, but it's not okay to go buy them at a gardening store, that it's okay to go buy a book at Walmart. I guess Walmart sells some books, but it's not okay to go to a bookstore or a small bookstore. It simply makes no sense, and it inflicted a lot of damage that was unnecessary. There was a bad framework for making these decisions from the beginning that I think has also inflicted a lot of damage. And by the way, you know, I don't want to seem hard-hearted or cruel, or to be wishing to inflict additional pain on anyone. But if they had made that distinction, if they had decided to operate that way, you know, it's possible that they would have taken another look at how our city and state employees are treated. You know, as of now, to the best of my knowledge, there's nobody who's on the city or state payroll, I'm not talking about contractors, I'm talking about people who are on the city or state payroll, has been told that they are being even laid off or furloughed temporarily, and none of them has been asked even so much as to take vacation, and at least run out their vacation for the time that they're at home, right? So, you know, there's that. I think to me is disturbing in sort of a sense of equality, that the government will make decisions that have these profound effects. Denver, you know, there was a study, just a survey that came out from WalletHub a couple of days ago, and it said that of the top 10 cities in the country that had been affected, I think Colorado had three of them, the Colorado Springs and Denver, and I forget who the third one was. But Denver was in the top five, I think, of cities that had been affected on a percentage basis in terms of people filing for unemployment. And yet, these decisions by the government, which are done, I believe, in the most part with the best of intentions, have profound effects on people's lives. And yet, you know, there seems to be maybe a special class of citizen who doesn't have to bear the brunt of this. And that to me is a little disturbing as well, especially when they work for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a little disturbing. Now, I think that there are some cities that have furloughed some employees. I think that Boulder furloughed, I want to say, over 1,000 employees. I'm like, Boulder,
yes,
has 1,000
right.
employees? And I'm
yes,
like,
you're right.
Whoa,
Boulder did.
That's
Boulder
a lot
did.
Of a lot of folks. The other thing I want to go back
Denver has,
on this.
Denver hasn't, and the state hasn't, and to me that's, and there's no talk of it. And to me that's at least make a listen. I mean, at least say we're going to make you run through your vacation. Now we understand. Okay, fine. You know, we don't want to cut payroll if we can avoid it. We don't want to put more people on unemployment if we can avoid. Okay, I sort of get that. But you know, at least if you're not essential, you're at home. You know, at least run through the vacation time so we can save some money on the back end. And then, you know, in September, November, when we're opening this up, you know, that we don't have that, at least we get a little bit of that liability off the books. And the fact is, you're getting to spend some, I mean, it's not a vacation really, but you're getting to spend some time at home, which is maybe, you know, which is something, which is not nothing. So.
Right, right. I want to go back to this face mask thing, and that is the force issue. And, you know, I'm not sure that the whole forcing face masks, these cloth face masks, somebody sent me something from, I think it was Varsoy Healthcare, where they had done an infographic on the effectiveness of the different types of masks, and your cloth masks, it said basically it really didn't make much of a difference. Now I've talked to Dr. Jill Vecchio, and she said, you know, it makes sense if you put some kind of a barrier, you know, you're probably going to prevent the spittle from going from one place to another. But my understanding is the virus is so small that it can actually get through these face masks. People say that it can get in through the eyes. The fact that people are putting these masks on their face means that they're fiddling with their face much more than they might otherwise. And so, you know, we can have the debate on face masks and the value of that or not. But the other issue is the force thing. And I think that this, again, is another way for these PBIs, these politicians and bureaucrats and interested parties to give themselves cover. Because I don't think that when we really push, as you're going to be doing, for the modeling on this, they're trying to cover their tracks in different ways, saying, see, we did this, and so that's why this happened. But another point, Joshua, is I have received a letter, a copy of a letter of a very good a senior care facility here in the metro area that was explaining to their community that the CDPHE has come in and is overriding the cause of death that the attending physician had put on the death certificates. They're overriding it, making it say COVID-19, in so much as it could possibly double their numbers than of COVID-19 deaths. And so once again, this is kind of some shenanigans that we're starting to uncover. And I really think the truth is going to come out, Joshua Sharp.
Well, that's a question of incentives. Not only do you have an incentive to make it look as now with things having been, you know, so fortunately reduced, they feel that they're fighting the other battle, which is of people not taking this seriously. I think at least part of the issue of people not taking it seriously was the inconsistency and the generally not well thought out way in which it was imposed in the first place. And so if you're telling people to do things that sort of intuitively don't make any sense, and you're not willing to explain why, and the masks are an interesting case here. The masks are an interesting case. I think there is, I mean, you're talking about the particles. Right. I mean, so it's, you know, better than nothing. It's obviously not an N95 mask, which will catch, you know, most of the viruses. So I get that there's a difference between that, and we'll set that aside. Where they really lost credibility with the masks was that initially they said, well, don't bother wearing them at all because they're really not necessary and they really don't do any good. And besides which, we have to make sure that the people on the front lines have the surgical masks and the N95 masks. And the last part of that actually makes sense, right? If you have people who are in constant, continuing, ongoing contact as part of their job with people who are sick with this thing and you're trying to prevent it from being spread, you want to make sure that those people don't get sick. And so that makes some sense. But what they didn't do was say, we want to make sure that what they did was start out by saying, well, it doesn't do any good anyway. Except then they turn around and say, well, it does do good. The reason that we said it didn't do any good is because we wanted to make sure that the people on the front lines had these things. So, you know, what they did was they basically blew a lot of credibility and just sort of made things worse rather than being honest up front. And saying, listen, you know, obviously it'll help, but what will also help is staying out of contact, and then you won't need a mask. And somebody who is in contact with people who are sick can get it. Instead, they didn't treat people like adults. And then they're surprised when people, you know, respond in a way that is resentful to having been manipulated.
Right. And so it's kind of the old thing of, you know, I mean, honesty between people, between individuals, but also between the citizens and their government is really, really important. And, you know, the question, politicians, bureaucrats, and interested parties are willing to fudge the truth over here, then why on earth would I trust them over here? And you mentioned something again in your piece that I thought was interesting, the Versailles court model of political power. So explain that just a little bit, okay?
Yeah. And this, I think, I think we've seen less of it here in Colorado, but you've seen it but we have seen it. And we've also seen it in particular in places like Michigan, or we've seen it in other places as well. But again, we've seen it here even in Colorado. The argument being that what's really going on in terms of power is disturbing in the long run. You have this idea that you're going to use, and Polis said this in his talk when he was talking about beginning to loosen things back up. He used the example, or the analogy, I should say, of a dimmer switch. You know, it's just going to flip the light back on and everything will go back the way it was. We're going to use this dimmer switch. And it implies, first of all, again, it sort of implies a level of precision that doesn't exist. But it also implies an ongoing exercise of emergency power out extended off into the future that becomes permanent. And so what you end up doing is waking up every morning and looking and seeing, well, what's allowed today? I mean, if you notice even last night, so we're recording this on Friday, Thursday night, April 30th, Thursday night, the governor signs a bunch of executive orders cutting this and in terms of the budget and cutting that, but also suspending, for instance, evictions. So now you're not, you know, now for a certain period of time, if somebody isn't paying their rent, they can't be evicted. I think most landlords probably weren't looking to kick a lot of people, kick people out in the first place, but putting a rule up there now, is a whole other level of stuff. And what it does mm-hmm. is it means that you're consistently looking to what the rules are today. What am I going to be allowed to do today? What am I not going to be allowed to do today? And it's a means of control. It creates a habit of thought of what you're allowed to do. And we've seen this with speech around politically correct speech. what am I allowed to say today? Well, what I said yesterday. Well, but that's not okay today. I mean, but yesterday, that was yesterday. You know, now our sensitivities have changed, and you're not allowed to say, understand there are certain words that are offensive and insulting and shouldn't be used. Understand also that political correctness has nothing to do with any of that. In a similar way, the model here is that you keep people in line by changing the rules and keeping them so occupied by figuring out what it is they can and can't do that they don't have time to step back and say, wait, this whole system is whack. And I think there's a certain level of political control there that there have to be some time limits on this. There have to be some limits there has to be some objective criteria for when you say, all right, this thing is over, and we're gonna live with it, and we're gonna live with what we have here. And if people catch this thing, it's just part of the landscape now. And we're gonna have to, and for instance, I'll give you an example here in Denver. There is very serious discussion among we talked about this was back in one of the previous, I think it was at the end of 2019. There was a vote. No, not the end. It was the middle of 2019. It was a vote on whether or not to have sort of permanent camps for the homeless, to repeal the camping ban. That was it. Yes. And so now homeless advocates are arguing that instead of putting people in putting them in the Coliseum or putting them in large arenas, large areas where they can spread out and people can be safe, that we should have outdoor for the duration of this. We should have outdoor camps with appropriate facilities and so forth that for homeless people that they can stay in and therefore their sort of health concerns will be taken care of with regard to this virus. And yet there's never any mention of, they say, well, it'll just be temporary. So show me the objective criteria for when this is over, because otherwise it isn't temporary. Otherwise it's permanent. And what you're doing is you're using this virus as an excuse, or even the fear of this virus as an excuse to push some other unrelated policy agenda that you've wanted forever anyway, but that people have said no to, and now you think you can get people to either vote for or overlook the fact that the city council is going to let happen. There's a use of political power, essentially at its essence, is unrelated to addressing the public health concerns.
Oh, Joshua Sharp, that is why this piece that you have written at Complete Colorado, it was published on April 20th, says the burden of proof lies with those locking us down. Joshua Sharp, we're just about out of time. What's the final thought that you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I mean, I think we just need to be, we need to remember who we are. We need to remember that we have responsibilities to each other, not to spread this thing, not to behave in irresponsible ways, and that we also have responsibilities to ourselves and to make sure that we keep the government in check and to its core mission here. The public health, I personally think, is a legitimate public health, especially in a time of a pandemic or an epidemic, is a legitimate function of government, and it actually has tended in the past to do reasonably well at that. What the concern is, and the alertness and the vigilance that we have to have now is to make sure that it doesn't that those legitimate exercises of power don't mutate into something far more virulent and something far more dangerous to our freedoms.
Okay, well, Joshua Sharp, Senior Fellow at the Independence Institute here in Denver, thank you so much for joining me for this podcast, sounding off with Kim Munson. God bless you and God bless America.